Okay, can you hear me? Yes, it's working. Many thanks, Tim, for an excellent talk. My name's Jonathan Leake. I'm the Science and Environment Editor at the Sunday Times. And I'm just going to say a few words, and then we're going to go straight into questions. So this is a particularly apposite time to be holding a discussion of this sort. We've heard from Tim about the scientific uncertainties in climate change and the sheer scale of the intellectual effort we need to try to reduce them. And some outside might question this, because, after all, given the compelling scientific evidence that adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere will warm the world in damaging ways, then the simple policy response would seem to be simply, let's find out how to cut those emissions. Maybe we don't need to know that much detail about the future, or so people have argued. But these questions have an importance that goes way beyond the scientific. Every country, every business, and every person wants to know how climate change will affect them. And what's more, the sense that scientists cannot accurately predict the consequences of climate change, or in some kind of dispute over the nature of those impacts, might be perfectly reasonable to the research community. That's how science gets done. But it can have a powerful effect on the perceptions of policymakers and the media. And we've seen that very clearly in the last year. So reducing uncertainty isn't just important for researchers. It's likely to be a key factor in the global political process that might save the world from dangerous climate change. So to discuss these issues, we've got four panellists. You've met Tim. To my far right, on your left, is Tim Linton, a professor of Earth System Science at the University of East Anglia. His research focuses on understanding the behaviour of the Earth as a whole system, especially through the development and use of Earth system models. And he's particularly interested in how life has shaped the planet in the past and what lessons we can draw from this as we reshape the planet ourselves. Vicky Pope is head of climate change advice at the Met Office. She was a founding member of the Hadley Centre in 1990, and she has a background in climate modelling and led one of the teams who developed the climate models used in the IPCC's third and fourth assessment. And on my left, Alan Thorpe, Chief Executive of the Natural Environment Research Council. His list of qualifications for this is far too long to read out, but just some of them include researching the basic dynamics and predictability of weather and climate. From 1999 to 2001, he was Director of the Hadley Centre. He became Chief Executive of NERC in April 2005. So, introduction's over. We're going to throw the floor open to questions in a minute, but first of all, I'm going to call on Kevin Horsburgh, who, at the top there. I'm not sure it's working.
Working now. Hello, I'm Kevin Horsburgh. I'm head of marine physics and ocean climate at the National Oceanography Centre. Tim has shown everyone that the climate models we use are very close relatives to the weather prediction models that we use for our short-range weather forecasts. Now, those models have got evaluations of them which are called skill scores, and we know that we can actually apply a skill score to our short-range weather forecasts. And not everyone in the audience might believe this, but those skill scores show quite demonstrably that the short-range weather models which we use are better than long-term statistics, they're better than just extrapolating the last few days, and they're better than plain guesswork. So the question is, for all of the properties that are of interest in a changing climate, and possibly for ensembles of climate models, do we possess similar skill scoring metrics for climate models, and how long do we have to wait for climate models before we can apply those metrics and see what the skill of the model is?
Who wants to say that one? Tim?
I've spoken enough. I can carry on if you like. Well, you're right, of course. I mean, climate change in the sense of what will happen in the next 100 years, we can't score that, as it were, till it happens. But I guess I would say a number of things. First of all, particularly I spoke about these three timescales, seasonal timescale, for example, and paleoclimate timescale. Now, seasonal timescale is about trying to make some predictions, for example, of the El Nino consequences of El Nino for the monsoons. It's an area where there is proven skill in the tropics in particular, a little bit more difficult perhaps in our latitudes because of chaos, but in tropics. So the types of models that are used to do seasonal prediction, which involve ocean models and atmosphere models, have a very substantial overlap with the sorts of climate models that are made to do 100-year predictions. So actually, by looking at skill scores on these seasonal timescales, we can actually assess how well these coupled ocean atmosphere climate models are doing in the next 6 months. At least that tells us something about the veracity of the dynamics of the coupled ocean atmosphere system. Not all aspects of it, but here again, I think the sort of going back the paleoclimate. At least it's not a skill score, but being able to simulate, being able to say we can simulate, things like these intraglacial oscillations, transitions from glacial to warm periods, and more recent aspects of climate. I think that's another, part of the tools that we use for testing climate models. So that's not exactly a skill score, but it's a measure of how realistic the simulations are for the monsoons, African climate, et cetera, et cetera.
Thanks, Tim. Alan?
Yes, I think obviously we've got quite an observational record of the 20th century, for example. Lots of detailed measurements with meteorological instruments and satellites, et cetera. So we know quite a lot about the climate, the weather and climate of that period. And so we go to a lot of trouble in the modelling and prediction community to test current models against the evolution of climate in the last 100 years. And there are, very statistical and mathematical ways of looking at the deviation of a climate model relative to a whole range of measurements that we have by, as it were, predicting what the 20th century would have been like, and then comparing it with the observations that we have. And there's many ways in which you can bring the observations to test those models against that observational database. And I think that's really important because that's the period when we really, as Tim mentioned, have had a huge number of very detailed measurements that we've been making. So I think it would be wrong to say that you can't test climate models. You certainly can for the recent past. And climate models have to pass that test to be able to be credible representations of the future.
Thank you.
Can I just ask, how are your models get on with predicting the warm period we had and the cold period we had a few hundred years back? How are they able to do that?
Let's just go through the rest of the panellists, I think, on that, and then we can come back on secondary questions. So, Vicky.
Yes, I just wanted to say something about the sorts of metrics that we use. So it's not just a question of comparing every observation with every type of model. It's also about understanding the processes that are important for climate change and focusing on those and making sure we have the observations and we can then test the models against those observations. So, for example, cloud feedbacks are very important for climate change, and much of the uncertainty still in the predictions arises around cloud feedback. So how much the cloud will increase, what type of cloud, and what impact that will have on climate. We now have much more sophisticated satellite measurements of cloud, which we can test the models against. And there are international projects taking the cloud measurements and taking the various different climate models from around the world and comparing those, not just looking at how much cloud there is, but actually the detailed properties of the clouds and making sure we can reproduce that. So it's really about understanding the important processes and testing those processes. And so over the last 5 years in particular, these sorts of metrics have been developed significantly so that we can actually test and obviously ultimately improve the models as well. And big improvements are being made now, and as we see from that sort of thing.
So a lot of our uncertainty about how much warmer it gets when the CO2 level is doubled or whatever is actually tied up with the fact that the part of the climate forcing from human activities that we have really ill-constrained is from aerosols and their effect on both direct cooling effects and indirect effects via cloud properties, as Vicky's just intonated. But as we're in the business of cleaning up our aerosol pollution, especially in the northern hemisphere at the moment, we could actually learn quite a lot in the coming decades constraining that key uncertainty in the forcing, which will in turn give us something of a better handle, at least on what's called the transient climate response, the transient warming, although it still doesn't constrain the long-term equilibrium warming, which is perhaps not such a tragedy because that's actually less relevant to policy. One slightly different line of attack I'll mention is that some of us believe, and working on this in the Institute, that we can deduce something directly from data about the stability of present climate states or modes. And this relates to the slide that Tim Palmer showed, that we're able to show that in the past, before abrupt climate changes, there were early warning signals of systems becoming more sluggish or less stable. And we're just trying now to develop those methods to the standard statistically, where you can begin to apply them to observational data and perhaps directly deduce something about the stability of the aspects of the system, which you would then use to perhaps recalibrate your models. And to the questioner in the middle, we do have models that do quite a good job of getting the medieval warm period and the subsequent little ice age, as it's called. Again, it can be an ensemble problem, as Tim Palmer described it. And actually, that can be partly to do an initial value problem. In other words, you can get an ensemble where some realizations capture those events and others don't. And then you may then weight your choice of what model you might run into the future according to that. And there are other groups, certainly a number of groups doing this.
I mean, that's like surprising. Hold on. I just wonder if I could ask you. I'm happy for you to ask a question, but could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Evan Parker from Warwick University, Physics. That's like surprising you could predict those things, bearing in mind that the current models, looking at current things, have got so much bias error on them, whereby you, in a sense, to look at variations, you have to sort of either eliminate this bias and say, we're not going to worry about that, we're just going to look at variations. Isn't that a very big factor, a very big worry in terms of predicting things that long ago where you have so little data? I just wonder whether you just want to vary the parameters until we get the fix, but it's not really telling as much about what's going on.
So those particular events are relatively small signals compared to the noise, if you like, but as others have mentioned, what we really should be able to do is have our state-of-the-art models capture the rather much larger and sometimes abrupt changes associated with it during the last ice age and from the last ice age to the Holocene. And, this is an active area of research. I believe we're making really good progress actually using these large paleoclimate changes to better constrain the models. One particular case study is this issue of climate sensitivity. How much warmer does it eventually get if you double CO2? You can use the lower CO2 levels in the depths of the last ice age, and your knowledge about the changes in other boundary conditions like large white ice sheets on large parts of the planet, and the known temperature change then to actually help pin down and in fact perhaps cut off the what's called the long tail of high values of climate sensitivity. So some of us believe that the last ice age climate essentially helps rule out climate sensitivities above about 5 or 4.5 degrees. Best guess is currently 3. If that's the case, that's very useful information. At least if you're thinking in the long term about built infrastructure and how much it might get warmer and how much the sea level might rise.
Okay, next question. Gentleman at the front. Keep your question as non-technical as you can, please.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm Nicholas Lewis, independent researcher. Current models with tuned parameters generally produce high climate sensitivities at 3 times being typical, and high temperature trends and other features that appear inconsistent with the latest data. Does the Newton Institute program address shortcomings in the basic physical modeling and the possibilities that parameters are not constant over time, as well as stochastic enclosure issues?
Are you addressing that question to Tim Palmer?
Primarily.
Okay. Sorry, primarily. Tim, you again.
By the way, just to pick up on one point early on in your talk, and I find it's an issue, and it might be a good opportunity just to, if you don't mind, expand on what you said about high sensitivity. I think a lot of people have the idea that this notion of the model's climate sensitivity, or in other words, you know, the feedbacks that might amplify the CO2 signal with water vapor or clouds and things, are things that are somehow tuned or somehow, you know, you specify in your model. So if you're a climate alarmist, you sort of crank up the feedbacks, you know, or if you're a climate conservative, you crank them down. And actually, it's not like that at all. These amplifiers, these feedbacks, are completely the internal properties of the model themselves. They're not things you can specify. And actually, I don't think the Met Office or any other climate institute in the world actually knows, short of them actually doing the forecasts, what their climate sensitivity of their model is going to be. It's an extremely difficult thing to predict because it involves these myriad interactions between different internal processes in the model. So you can't tune a model, as it were, to have a high or low climate sensitivity. The parameters relate to the actual basic physical processes, the clouds, the convective systems, turbulence in the boundary layer, all this sort of stuff. And there isn't any sense of one-to-one mapping between the values of these parameters and the climate sensitivity. Observations are crucially, I mean, as Alan said, I mean, there's been a lot of investment to try to pin these parameters down. But, I mean, I think you're right to say that it's not the case that there is a unique parameter that is correct. And to some extent, I think that kind of goes to part of the program at the Newton Institute to kind of rethink these closure schemes so that we don't have these fixed parameters, and so things that actually are variables are represented stochastically. So it's a new area of science. It's a new area of bringing maths into physics. We'll make use of the observations. And just one thing, once I've got the floor, I mean, somebody asked me, will we be able to say from the Newton Institute whether climate sensitivity is going to be 2 degrees, 3 degrees, or 4 degrees? Well, that's not really what we're doing in the program. What we're trying to do is develop really basic science that will go into the models and it won't affect the numbers probably in this current IPCC assessment, the one that's actually now being written, but hopefully the next one it will.
I'm a bit worried about the terminology of these being parameters. It makes it sound a little bit as though it's as you hinted in your question, as though it's something you can play with and it's a bit dirty. But actually, you know, from the point of view of what I do in Natural Environment Research Council, we put a lot of research effort into understanding how, for example, clouds, which we've been talking about, how clouds work. So on a very fine scale, making measurements and detailed understanding of the interactions between cloud droplets, rainfall, solar radiation, etc. And from all of that knowledge, you can construct essentially a cloud model, which is a subcomponent of a climate model. And we tend to call that, it gets kind of parceled up into the term parameter. But actually, it's traceable back to that understanding of how individual cloud systems operate. So a lot of the research that my research council does is about these physical processes and actually looking at clouds, looking at the stratosphere that Tim mentioned, looking at the surface of the Earth and how it interacts with the lower atmosphere in detail so that the submodels can be well represented in the climate models. And that's really where the reducing the uncertainty comes in. The more we can improve that detailed knowledge, the more that these submodels will be accurate and can be put into the climate model. So to call them parameters gives the impression, perhaps a slightly wrong impression about what they are, I think.
They do vary between models, something like
the training. Absolutely, because they incorporate, in many respects, they're having to incorporate a whole range of physical processes, because as Tim says, unfortunately, we can't actually slot in a detailed set of cloud models within the climate model. It'd be great if we could do that, and maybe one day we will be able to do it. But at the moment, we have to somehow collapse that information down, and that's where, as you say, different versions of that collapsing lead to different descriptions. And we've got to reduce that uncertainty. Absolutely, it's important.
Okay, Tim, and then Vicky.
Just purely from the observations, we can set a lower bound on the climate sensitivity. We know it's not below about 1.6, 1.7 degrees of warming for doubling CO2. But because of this uncertainty in the forcing from effects of aerosols, particularly on clouds, it's possible that we live in a world where the net total human forcing, radiative forcing, as we call it, is quite close to zero, and yet we've still observed nearly a degree of warming. And that's going to turn out to be a high sensitivity world, and we can't rule that out. We may learn more about that quite quickly if we continue to remove the aerosols. But there's another factor here, which is if you want to look at these high, ultimately high climate sensitivity worlds, those are ones where you have to have the heat going into the whole bulk of the ocean, which is a very, very slow process. And Jim Hansen and others showed back in the 80s that the eventual equilibration time to see the full temperature response goes with the square of the sensitivity, effectively. In other words, you really won't know, and one only finds that out on the longest timescales. For the policy discourse, though, the important thing is what we call the transient climate response, which is the shorter term, if you like, transient warming. And that we, well, for the reasons just described, we may get a better handle on, not least by if we continue to clean up our aerosols.
Just adding to the things that have been said, really, we're just in the process of running our latest climate model, and we're starting to look at the results and finding that actually there's some quite surprising things coming out of it, which I won't go into in detail because we don't understand them yet. But the new model is an system model, so it includes more degrees of freedom. It includes the carbon cycle feedbacks and the impact on plants and chemistry and so on as standard. Every time you introduce more degrees of freedom, of course, you have much less control over what the model's going to do. So you really don't have any idea what the climate sensitivity is going to be, and it is actually rather different to the models. It's higher, actually, than previous models. The aerosols have also changed substantially, and some of these sorts of feedbacks and offsets we're only starting to understand. So it's really important to represent all the processes in these models and for different modelling groups to use different approaches to make sure we really get to the bottom of understanding this. And it certainly isn't something that we can tune. The other thing I was just going to say was, I think in understanding, going back to the understanding of cloud processes in particular, which affects particularly the lower end of the climate sensitivity range, it's looking increasingly that the lower climate sensitivities are less realistic in the sense that the physical properties in the models that lead to those low climate sensitivities, largely to do with clouds, actually don't look very realistic when you compare them with observations. So it does look as though the sort of anything below 2 degrees doesn't look very credible. So the higher ones do look credible, and maybe with the sort of things that Tim was talking about, we can rule out these very high values, and hopefully we can narrow down that range and really get to grips of what the climate sensitivity is.
Okay. Just a quick reminder, this is... we've essentially been focusing on the science a great deal so far, but this is quite a mixed audience. And I'd urge anyone who is from perhaps the policy field to not, or any other field, finance perhaps, to put their questions too. Because the important thing we want to do here is translate science into what it means for policymakers and for people involved in other areas of activity. So, gentlemen up there. Most difficult to access with the microphone, I think. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Falk Niehurster from the Grantham Institute of the LSE. Just taking up your point, I want to ask a question regarding like the utility of the model output we actually have. So in policy as well as in industry, as we all know, it's quite important to know something about the confidence we have of the model output, because this leads, in fact, to substantially different categories of a decision-making process. So if we have a high confidence, we can take model output maybe as a probability distribution and can apply cost-benefit analysis. But like, if we have only a low confidence, we have to think in a scenario type of approach and have different techniques to come to optimizing our decision. So my question is, you might have, as you are the experts, some advice for us and the community where we should go with our decision-making approaches given your confidence in the models.
Okay. I'm going to ask Vicky to answer that one.
I think, Tim said it to some extent, when we're looking at global changes large-scale changes that happen over long time periods, and we can give much higher confidence. So we know that the climate is changing. We know that it will change in the future if we carry on increasing emissions. When we start to look at, for example, what's going to happen in the UK and what we should be doing with infrastructure, then, of course, the local changes and the regional changes are much less certain. And that's why we adopt a probabilistic approach and a risk-based approach. But in those areas where perhaps we have less confidence, I think there's a number of things that we can do. First of all, we can provide probability distributions and use a risk-based approach. But also, you can look at scenarios in combination with that. So look at the worst case scenario, the best case scenario, and actually it's about then understanding your attitude to risk. So if you have a very low probability event, but that a very high cost event, either in monetary terms or human terms, then you may want to look at that very seriously. Whereas if it doesn't have a high cost, then you would probably ignore it. And the other aspect of that is to say, well, do I need to make all my investment up front to cope with that? Or can I put a watching brief on it and say, well, you know, this is a low probability, high impact event. It's going to be really expensive for me to make a change now to adapt to it. But maybe in 20 years' time, I'll have better information. And also, by doing that, you can come back to us and say, well, this is the information that I need, so that, you know, over 20 years, we can, or maybe shorter, maybe 5 years, we can actually tailor the work that we do to say, well, let's try and focus on this particular aspect of the problem. So, for example, yeah, you might not be interested in what the seasonal average temperature is going to be in 2050, which is what we'll tell you at the moment from the UK climate projections. You might want to know, are there going to be, you know, what's a 10-day heat wave going to look like in that timescale? And so we can focus on those sorts of things and try to improve some elements of extreme prediction. So I think I would say it's kind of partnership approach, that it shouldn't just be the scientists going off and producing better predictions. We need to actually work with users as well to say, well, what is it that you need? And if we can't provide that information now, can we do something about providing that in the future?
Tim.
So I support Vicky in that we need some kind of risk assessment, risk management approach. My own interest, or that of my group and others in the Institute, has been looking at identifying so-called climate tipping points or thresholds, particularly at a sort of subcontinental scale. So do we get to a certain temperature at which we commit the Greenland ice sheet to go into progressive meltdown, or is there a threshold at which we commit dieback of the Amazon rainforest and so forth? And when in the last 5 years, looking hard as a modeller at the models, you have to be honest with yourself and say, when you get down to regional scales, West Africa would be a classic example, there's real problems with many of the models. You can look among, say, 23 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report models, and for West Africa, find three of them that are looking a lot better than the others for capturing the current pattern of rainfall, and you might have some faith in then their predictions for the future. But the point is, we don't just use models if we're smart. We also try to build up a picture of whether systems are vulnerable based on their behavior in the past. So there's paleoclimate and observational record. We use our basic fundamental physical, chemical, biological understanding of the processes at work to see whether we've got a scientific justification for believing there might be strong non-linearity and threshold behavior. And in terms of trying to then get some information, if you want to do risk assessment, you need to know something about likelihood and something about impacts. And to get likelihood information, we don't just knowing the problems with the models. For example, groups I've been involved in, we've done expert elicitation, quite detailed expert elicitation processes to try and extract information that's held, if you like, by the scientific community, but not well captured in the models at present. And I could mention a number of other sources of information. On the other side of the coin, of course, we've got to have better information on what the impacts would be if Greenland is it, for example, at the moment in the process of retreating up onto land and giving us a metre or a metre and a half of sea level rise. And to be honest, there's a little bit of a shortage of these kind of impact studies focused more on these, what you might call, larger scale tipping point changes. There's a huge body of literature in certain areas of impact research, but I think there's still room to improve our knowledge base in a way that Vicky was hinting at on the impact side of the equation as well as the likelihood side.
Do you want to say anything about Tim?
Perhaps the only thing to say is that, just broadly following Vicky, that regional predictions will be necessarily of a kind of probabilistic nature. And I think for companies and governments and things who are particularly looking maybe at adaptation infrastructure decisions, I think they have to be made in the context of decisions made with imperfect imprecise climate prediction data. And as I mentioned in my talk, I think the UK CP09 data set was a really kind of landmark first attempt to provide probabilistic forecasts to the user community. And I would sort of encourage people, if people in the audience are likely to be involved in this issue about how do, you know, their companies or whatever make decisions that have to take account of future climate change, at least to get some experience of developing decision analytic tools, the kind of thing that the speaker mentioned, with this type of data set, I think is really important to kind of flesh out the issues. Hopefully the science will, you know, well, the science is developing, so UK CPO9 is not the last word in this. It's an ongoing process. But developing those decision analytic methods, I think, is an important thing for us and the user community to start working towards.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Gentleman down here in the third row up. Thank you.
My name is Kelly. I'm from Cambridge. All of you, starting with Tim, emphasized the difficulty with clouds and partly the scale of the size of clouds, but also the actual properties of clouds and whether or not the effects of clouds are altered by particulate emissions by man. But in the Royal Society critique of the science of climate change, an equally important aspect of aspects that are defined as not well understood is the scale of uptake of CO2 by the land and the oceans. Now, we know from very direct observation that only about half of the CO2 emissions that we make as men due to fossil fuels, and we know it's due to fossil fuels from isotope and other analyses. But we don't understand, according to the Royal Society group, well enough at all the uptake of CO2 by the land and oceans. Now, that's quite crucial on a number of points, because it is particularly important for the long-term prediction, and particularly the life of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it was just a general question to Tim and the other two experts. You said you're doing
Tim?
Things about
both very good
ice, about clouds. What are you doing about this particular additional aspect?
Okay, well, let's do the Tim's first. Tim.
Okay, so you're quite right that uncertainty in the response of the carbon cycle in a changing climate is a key source of uncertainty in the future projections. We do have a fairly detailed and increasingly detailed view of how the land and ocean sinks, as we call them, are behaving up to now. But the big uncertainties come in the possibility that the land that's currently a sink has a possibility to switch to a source, because temperature-driven respiratory carbon loss processes may overtake a essentially saturating response of photosynthesis to rising CO2. Peter Cox is lurking in the back of the audience, some one of the people who first put a coupled carbon cycle in a general circulation model and published that in the year 2000. 10 years of intervening work mean that most, if not all, the major modelling groups, and I mean the real top-end models, are now grappling with putting a coupled carbon cycle in. At the same time, we can go back to these other methods of using the past to try and constrain the uncertainties or the space of possibility. Even the depths of the last ice age again tell us something useful about how carbon storage on land is sensitive to both CO2 and temperature changes, as do more recent events. They give us some scope to tie down the uncertainty. But still, indeed, more work to do there. And you're correct that this is a key thing in the forecast. But there's some aspects of it which is really well understood science, and I should emphasize that. So in terms of the response of ocean chemistry and the fact that it's essentially nonlinear, and that the more carbon you add to the system and the more carbon goes into the ocean, the greater the fraction actually that will reside in the atmosphere will be, that's very well tied down. And we can be very sure, including from events 55 million years ago, that if you put a release of 1,000 billion tonnes of carbon or of that order into the Earth system, it will take hundreds of thousands of years for both the carbon dioxide to be removed and the temperature to come down. That's consistent with all our mechanistic understanding. that actually a fraction of the CO2 pollution, a minimum 20% fraction, is more longer-lived pollution than nuclear waste, in fact.
Now, with respect to
I'll tell you what, I'm just going to interrupt you there, if I may. I'm told, if you'll permit me, that we've got an expert on this topic in the audience, Peter Cox. Peter, are you willing to speak on this, just very briefly?
You might. I tried to get as far away as I could, but obviously not quite far enough. So to back up what Tim was saying, we do understand quite well the timescales associated with oceanic uptake, and there is a very long tail on that. What we're not so clear on is why the land is taking up carbon, and that determines the future of that land carbon sink. But something we've been doing at the Newton Institute is to look at how variability in CO2 from year to year provides some constraint on that, and that's really promising, actually. It's something that's been emerging in the last couple of months. So if you look at the Mauna Loa record, for example, the year-to-year variation probably tells you how sensitive the land in the tropics is to climate. And that's one of the key uncertainties. So we can actually use short timescale variability to pin down some of these long timescale changes. We're not there yet, but I think we're making good progress.
Tim.
I just wanted to, in case people were getting confused, a lot of these issues about carbon cycle uncertainty are perhaps more relevant when we come to think about sort of post-2100, kind of really going out into the next century or so. For more of the sort of climate service type issues, where I was perhaps thinking of the next 50 years or up, you know, 2050 up to 2100, I think actually it is the clouds, again, that provide the key uncertainties, and the carbon cycle is less perhaps of an issue. So it's very much a timescale dependent, which uncertainty you think is the dominant one.
Okay.
Just a very brief comment again from a research funder. These issues, and particularly the carbon cycle and biogeochemical cycles in general, is something that we've been putting a lot of effort into and a lot of focus on. So I wouldn't want the general audience to think that, raising areas of uncertainty that some other research community are not active on these areas. They're complicated and difficult areas, but we're putting a lot of research money and scientific effort into making measurements of the carbon cycle over land and in the oceans, actually, and other interacting biogeochemical cycles. So knowledge is advancing, and of course there is remaining uncertainty that we have to continue to reduce. But it would be wrong to start this conversation off by saying we don't know anything, and therefore we need to move forward. We know quite a lot. We're putting a lot of effort into it. Absolutely.
I think it's a good point, and it's been well made, yeah. Rowan.
I think the city risk mongers have been remarkably quiet so far. So uncharacteristically quiet, I hasten to add. So I'm going to perhaps break the ice. And to John, Rowan Douglas from Willis, and in response to your request, Jonathan, I'm going to ask a very explicit sort of business and perhaps even policy-orientated question. We're all very concerned about climate, but I think the insurers and other risk mongers in this room are particularly concerned about the weather that actually obviously forms part of those climate regimes. And particularly, they'll be concerned about extreme events, the location, frequency, and severity of those. And as I'll say a little later, we are seeing some emerging supply chains from climate modelling through to catastrophe modelling through to capital. So I'm going to ask the scientific panel, if I may, to assume the role of an underwriter. I know that is a huge, and I see that's a huge step down from your current ivory tower positions, but just to bear with me. So imagine you are an underwriter focused on the UK over the next 10 years. We're taking big bets. And in the UK, we're worried about three basic hazards, or as we say in our market, perils. We're worried about windstorm, including storm surge. We're worried about pluvial rainfall. And we're worried about heat waves and prolonged, particularly if you're a life insurer. Now, if we were to be relying on climate models now, and where you think they may be heading over the next decade, which of those perils would you be most confident that your models could provide some sort of valuable information to us to understand these extremes? And which of those perils would you feel that, frankly, we're going to be challenged to add anything significant to our fundamentally historically based analysis? So UK windstorm, pluvial-based flooding, and particularly summer heat waves.
Thank you, Ryan.
Because that's what matters to us.
Alan's in charge of pretty much all that research, so maybe we'll start with him.
I think Vicky would have a better view of this than me, but I'm going to try to get into the spirit of betting, Rowan, which I wouldn't normally do as scientific background. But I think all of these are difficult because, in principle, you're talking about extreme events and you're talking about changes in the frequency of these events. But I think we all know that rainfall and ultimately then into flooding is currently a seriously difficult problem because of, as we've already talked about, the scale issue, and it's often localised, etc. And but it's one that we're putting an awful lot of research effort into. So, and I think in terms of windstorms, that's an area where historically there's been a lot of research to understand, and I think we understand quite well the dynamics and physics of windstorms, but again, it's the subtle change in the frequency of the extreme part of that that's critical. So my list would be that I think the flooding and rainfall one is pretty tricky. I think the heat waves are something that overall in the UK we probably are beginning to get a pretty good picture of, and I'd put windstorms in the middle. But I think I wouldn't agree with your final comment, which is that you characterise it that some of these we wouldn't be able to make any progress on. I think we're pretty active in all of these, and I think in many respects they're linked, of course, because they depend, as Tim mentioned in his lecture, on the regimes of variability global as well. So it's not just to do with the UK windstorms, because the frequency of those depend on the global variability patterns. And so it is genuinely a global problem, although its impacts are locally felt. So I think they're all interlinked, and in a way their progress, their understanding of progress goes hand in hand.
But just as a follow-up, do you feel, Alan, that over the next 10 years there will be a marked change in the reduction of uncertainty of understanding these extreme events, or do you think that's unlikely?
I think that if we get enough support for the research community... from important organisations like yours, I think we can make real progress. And, you know, the UK science community is world leading in this subject. And as you well know, we in a sense punch above our weight. We're a small community, but we are doing really excellent research internationally. But, you know, as we hit into economically difficult times, I am concerned that we'll continue to make as good progress. Because the amount that we can particularly support on the areas that Tim finished up with on the computing, for example, the limitations are often financial to be able to have the money to do that. And also on observations, which again are seriously expensive to do. And as we head into slightly more difficult times financially, I'm concerned that the rate of progress may slow. But I think in the UK you know, I'm optimistic that we'll continue to make good progress.
Okay, many thanks. Vicky.
Right, well, thank you for that intro, Alan. And you've dealt with the funding issues, I won't talk about that. It's generally easier to predict temperature than it is to predict rainfall and winds. And heat waves actually fall into that category as well as the average temperature. So I think in terms of predicting changes in the frequency of heat waves, you know, we should be able to do a reasonable job on that. Now, if you're talking about the next 10 years in terms of the predictions for the next 10 years, then actually understanding what, how current climate has already changed is really important. Actually, that's probably the most critical factor. And we've got very strong evidence now that we're already seeing changes in the frequency of heat waves. So that there was a study done a few years ago, which we always quote, on the heat wave of 2003, which spread right across Europe. And we can already say that that's probably four times as likely now as it was before the Industrial Revolution. So even without using any predictions, actually making sure we're using the right climatological information is really important. So we've produced climatology, for example, for use in the energy industry, and it's available more widely, which rather than using just historical data, it actually makes use of the decade prediction to come up with a better climatology for the UK, and it turns out that we can get better information from that. And so for things like temperature, that's actually very useful. So it's about combining information from observations, from predictions that we have, improving the predictions, and also our understanding of the climate as well. And I think that's where, on the rainfall side of things, I think it's the predictions of rainfall are very difficult, but there are certain situations. For example, if we get the same type of event occurring in the future, we might expect heavier rain to come from it. So the flooding that we had in 2007, for example, we had particular weather conditions which were just unusual, just a natural variability. Instead of the storms in the summer going north of the UK, they came right across the UK. But in combination with that, we had very warm sea surface temperatures, and that was a hangover from the previous summer in 2006, which had been very warm in Europe. So that the warm sea surface meant that we got lots of moisture into the storms and lots of rainfall over the UK. So it was a combination of a climate change-like event, and whether that was climate change cause, we don't know, but the type of event you might see in the future is warm sea surface temperatures more frequently, combined with a natural phenomena of these storms coming across the UK. And it's those two things coming together. So in terms of predicting that type of change, we need to be able to obviously reproduce that in our models and know maybe those types of rainfall events will be less frequent. We don't know. But in combining our predictions, improving the predictions, but also our understanding of how the climate system works, we can actually give some information. It's not just a question of raw model output, it's actually using that scientific understanding as well. In terms of windstorms, I would actually put that lower down the list than Alan did. I think in terms of the, if you look at the predictions in IPCC reports, you look at the predictions we've done in the UK climate projections, actually the winds show very little skill. They're sort of quite wide ranging in terms of what happens in the future. We don't really know that well what's happening. But I would say that I think there's a significant opportunity in the next 10 years of research to actually improve this. There's emerging evidence, I think, coming from work, certainly work being done by Adam Scaife in the Met Office, and I'm sure Tim knows more about this as well, work that he's doing, where it may be by making improvements in our models, particularly in the resolution of the models, that actually we can get better handle on the large-scale synoptic systems, the weather systems, and therefore the winds that go with those. So I think there's significant scope for improvement in the future. Obviously, computer power is a factor, but actually our understanding of the science and our representation of that science is also improving.
Thanks, Vicky. Tim.
I'll put my money on the summer heat waves, especially if it's associated with the persistent blocking events that Tim Palmer mentioned. I think it's conceivable that we might be able to make more progress applying these ideas that if you can characterize various regimes, for example, for the position of the jets or whether the jet stream's forming a ring or a corkscrewing around the planet, and or equivalently at sea surface, the positions of the westerlies, if there are sort of if it's characterizable as there being regimes there and the system under human forcing the population of those regimes, as other Tim described, may be gradually changing. We do have some feeling now that, based on our analysis of paleo data, that there can be some forewarning signals or some indicators of that one regime is becoming maybe less stable or less populated and another more stable or more populated. And I believe there's a way forward simply by almost by direct interrogation, intelligent direct interrogation of the data to look for early warning signals or trends at least, try to extract if there are statistically significant trends in the population of the different modes. We certainly tried to do this from looking at 2003 summer heatwave data and saw some fascinating signals before the heat wave struck, but I don't think it's publishable as yet. I think this is one of these areas where it could be worthy of more research, and a really intelligent approach would combine the state of the art and the data analysis with training, then training the models to be better models. So I'm not an expert on those particular things I mentioned. I know Tim Palmer's more so, and Brian Hoskins looks in the room somewhere as well. But I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that there are tools that are to do with looking for dynamical properties purely in the data over time that might teach us something useful.
Thank you. Tim, if you got your supercomputer, would you be able to tell Rowan any of the things then that you can't tell him now?
Yes.
What would you tell him? What could you do?
We'll tell you everything. Everything you want to know, we can tell you. I have to say, my kind of, I'm sort of slightly speaking with a sort of gut feeling here, but my kind of worst fear, the climate change for the UK will be these kind of persistently wet winters. You know, this actually somewhat the opposite of the blocking anticyclone, where you just get weather system after weather system. Cockermouth was a good example. You obviously can't predict whether it's going to be Cockermouth or Reading or, you know, London or whatever. But this type of persistent mild winter that just saturates the ground. Farmers can't grow any winter wheat because it's all, you know, the ground saturated. Any houses in low-lying areas will just be perpetually underwater. I think this is going to be one of the really, for me, is my gut feeling is, and of course that type of flow does bring in windstorms from time to time, but again, it's not particularly predictable, but that type of really miserable type of weather, that's my worst fear for the UK.
Okay, there's a gentleman in the fourth row.
Give me the money and we'll really tell you.
Thank you. Ken Atkinson from AWE. It's really a question about the computing, and it's a general question to the panel, but I guess also more focused to Tim Palmer. What sort of power of supercomputer, if I could give you one today, could you use, not just dream about having, but could you utilise sensibly, so if it was a platform that was solely for climate change? And I suppose a corollary question is actually, what value would it be to the insurance brokers if you could double your estimate of predictions, you know, your probabilities?
Thank you.
And what do you think you ought to spend on it?
Are you targeting Tim Palmer, or is that a...
It's a general question to the panel, because I think it's a given that supercomputing is needed for climate prediction and climate modelling. So it's germane to what does this cost us? What could it cost us if we were to fund a centre and a facility to do it?
Alan,
probably a facility.
Kind of your area, to some extent.
I think Tim should answer first of all, actually. As he's been very eloquent about actually how we couldn't necessarily do it on our own in terms of computational power. You know, we need to do better at linking across Europe and even, you know, wider than that. But how much power do we need? It's a good question. I've often asked you this.
Actually, I mean, you can see by the nature of the drivers for computer power that there isn't actually, you can't just say, give me, you know, one petaflop or one exaflop, and that will solve the problem.
But you could use something and get better models.
Yeah, I mean, the current top tier computers now are at several petaflops, 10 to the power 15 floating point operations per second.
Most of them are used for open science, so not used for a single problem.
That's right. So if I'm a climate modeler, I can maybe get 5% or something like that if I'm lucky. So there's nothing dedicated to climate, actually anywhere in the world, even in the US and Japan. I mean, my dream, if you'd like to call it that, is to be able to actually resolve these deep convective clouds that I talked about, because they actually, as I say, drive the transport of heat and moisture into the atmosphere. But you know, I mean, God, if God exists, he clearly wasn't a climate modeler, because the two modes of instability in the atmosphere are the two key modes, the so-called baroclinic instabilities, which determine our weather patterns in mid-latitudes. And these have scales of 1,000 kilometers, and models can resolve those quite well. But the other are these convective instabilities, which occur on just scales of a few kilometers. So there's an enormous disparity of scale. So my ambition is to get to a kilometer resolution. Unfortunately, I can't tell you, if you want me to put my hand on my heart, I can't tell you how much that will reduce uncertainty. But all I know is I will be representing the climate physics, the climate system with the laws of physics much more accurately. What will do it? I think something around 100 petaflops to one exaflop. Exaflop, 10 to the power 18 floating point operations per second. The computer manufacturers reckon they'll be there in about 2018. Climate change, by the way, is going to be with us for centuries, possibly even millennia, so don't think of 7 or 8 years as a long time. How much will it cost? It'll cost about a typical satellite program. The cost to ESA, European Space Agency, of putting a big satellite program, this will be about the cost. So we're talking of, you know, potentially hundreds of millions of pounds or euros. But now, you see, we don't have these big discussions about satellite programs. I mean, satellite programs are important, but we don't have these big discussions about them because there's a big aerospace industry in Europe, and there's industrial return on funding space-based observations. So I have nothing. I mean, space-based observations are really important, but we don't discuss them because there's this industrial return. Problem for Europe is we don't have a supercomputer manufacturer to have industrial return on, and that is the problem for science. So yeah, give me something between 100 petaflops and one exaflop in about 5 years' time. I will make use of it, and I will answer all of Rowan's questions and hopefully get uncertainty down to a really tiny range.
Okay, Alan, would you...
Just to come back in, I mean, a key question for me is really to balance how much we spend on computing power and versus observations. And the balance in... I think in the Natural Environment Research Council funds, anyway, is distinctly on observational capability. Now, maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but that's the kind of debate that we have to have, because we've got the budget that we've got. We spend quite a bit on computing, but we spend more probably on observations. And when Tim says that we don't discuss satellite missions, we do, because we do contribute nationally to ESA. Via a subscription, and that's becoming, you know, again, increasingly difficult to sustain. So it's always trying to balance, because we, you know, if we had a vast increase in computational power without the commensurate observational capability, then it wouldn't be balanced again. And to me, it's getting that balance right between the investment that we do. I'm not saying it's necessarily right at the moment, but it needs to be debated together, I think.
Vicky.
Just to add one point, really, which was whatever computer power we have and whatever observations we have, it's really important that we make the best use of what we've got. And if we do get part of the way there, we won't be able to do everything that we want. There are choices that you have to make. I think Tim had six different things on his diagram that need computer power, and they are always competing with each other. You need ensembles, you need high resolution, you need complexity, and actually, even with that size of computer, you probably couldn't do all of those things at once. So to some extent you can use high resolution, for example, for very short model runs to actually understand the processes, and sometimes you can then use that information to improve the other models that you have. So it's the scientific process and the understanding and really making the best use of what you've got is also part of it, I think. But you can't, you know, if you don't have the basic tools, of course you can't do it.
Okay, Tim.
Yes, I was going to say that there's an awful lot we could do with making better use of resources we already have. So the Research Council's in recent years funded a whole e-science program, and you will have heard of climateprediction.net, no doubt. And at my own group with the Gini model, if you want to do a comprehensive, statistically justified, if you like, search of both parameter uncertainty and potentially also structural uncertainty across the models, then you really want to run many, 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 many instances of your models. Your strategy, or at least our existing strategy, is we go to a somewhat reduced complexity, more computationally efficient model that maybe we can run on a single processor and port it between operating systems, and then we farm those jobs out across the grid or across willing users who will run the model as their screensaver. And in that way, we can actually begin to do a statistically more justifiable search of the model space with existing and essentially cheap resources. And I think we've made real progress on that in recent years, but I believe we could make more progress on that at relatively low cost. And that would teach us something scientifically interesting.
Okay, many thanks, Tim. There's a guy here in the second row. Oh, sorry, do you want to come back?
I wonder if I could ask this. I'm thinking of the issue of we don't have real computing base. This is not, is it?
We can still hear you here.
Great. Okay. Tim raised the question of the absence of a supercomputing base in Europe. And so I wonder if I could ask, through you, ask actually Ralph Cicerone about how the supercomputing strategy in the United States, how it links into the suppliers and so forth, and one expects that might actually be handled rather more coherently as a big investment policy of great advantage both to the suppliers and to the scientists as well as to potentially end users. Is that okay, Jonathan?
Sure.
Thank you, David. Historically, I think the demand for supercomputing in the United States has been driven by military and intelligence agencies. But that has changed in the last decade or so, that some of the strongest support for supercomputing projects and pushing the envelope forward is from potential medical applications, genomic computing, frontiers yet to come. I think, if anything, the drive due to meteorological and climate demand has decreased in the United States, because just as Tim Palmer said, the UK's resources may have been in the top five not long ago, and now they're more like in the 50s. It's the same with our meteorological and climate institutions. They're no longer at the top in computing because these other demands have grown so fast.
Okay. The gentleman down here had a question.
Ian Sohn from Impact Asset Management. At a time when the subsidies in the energy industry run to the hundreds of billions of dollars, that's for fossil fuels, and actually subsidies for renewable energy are in the tens of billions of dollars, it's perverse and frustrating that there's not enough resource going into this area. And I wondered whether you could comment a little bit more imaginatively about how policy can help modelling rather than modelling always helping policy. I wonder whether you could comment in a bit more detail, first of all, about how institutionally we could get the computing power that we need by combining, for example, at a European level in a CERN type project. And separately, whether there's more that can be done imaginatively on the data collection. We hear a lot about mobile phones being used as sensors now for all sorts of things. Enhanced reality is a phrase that's starting to be used in all a variety of policy domains. Is there more that can be done in the smart meter program, such that smart meters can be wired somehow to the rooftops of houses to send back weather information? Would that kind of data collection really help to turbocharge the modelling process?
Okay, very interesting question. Vicky, I think it sounds like very much your area.
I'll deal with the data question, and maybe other people can comment on the supercomputing. I think the biggest issue for climate data, I'm talking about climate now rather than weather, is making sure we have long data sets and continuity of those data sets so that you can actually look for change over long periods of time. And there is actually a lot of data out there that hasn't been digitized yet. So it's data that's sitting on ships' logs, data that was collected by sort of vicars in the English countryside that's never been digitized, and various other sorts of things. And so there's actually an initiative to help to digitise some of that data, and actually to use the public to help to do that. So people who are interested will be able to help by keying in some of that data so that it can be put into the global system and shared amongst researchers and used in that way. So that, I think, is one way that that you know, the general public also can get engaged in the climate issue as well by actually participating, not just in running the model as their screensaver, but actually in analysing data. And there's been a lot of interest, of course, in that in the last year. The other thing I was going to say was that now that actually there's a big push to make data available to people, and the data that's being used in the surface temperature data sets is now available on our website. It's the stuff that people have given permission for. It was an interesting development that came out of that was that we put the Russian data out there and we said, oh, there's 100 stations or something. And they said, oh, well, no, we've got another 200. Aren't you using those? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that there's some data that they thought that they'd given into the system, but it wasn't there, and that will be added. So that will give more information on the Arctic, for example. So I think there's a lot that can be done with data, just on a fairly basic sort of level, actually, as well as obviously new data sets that are needed as well. So.
Okay, thanks. Alan, that sounds like your area too.
We're definitely doing research on innovative instrumentation and to monitor the state of the environment. Using the public and all of the things that you mentioned, mobile phones, etc. So it's definitely an area of important development in measurement. Actually, I wanted just to make a point that links to Ralph's point as well, that in making the case, as Tim eloquently does, for more investment into computing for climate, actually the issue is to do with the extent to which we can make the case for climate change research in itself. In the first place, we are in a sense competing for other really big societal issues that are commanding resources, and the medical area, that the biological area, the genomic area, these are areas that when I started in doing research in climate and weather, they weren't really using computing, but there's a revolution taking place there. They're catching up really fast in terms of the potential for systems biology and using computational power and data access, and often, in a sense, using some of the advances in our field to develop there. So it's not a given that the government or society regards climate change science as the top priority, although we would think it was. It's not necessarily the case. So one of the things I find myself doing at this time when we're going through our comprehensive spending review is really making the case not so much for computing, but making the case for climate research being critically important. And that, I'm afraid, whether we like it or not, is to some extent balanced against the other societal challenges that we face, whether they be economic, whether they be the broadband revolution, whether it be the medical area, which tends to, certainly in this country in recent decades, has done relatively well compared to other areas of research. I just think we need to continue our eloquence on this, and the existence of this meeting, the sort of interest from the reinsurance industry, is really powerful message to the government that business really wants this kind of science going forward. And we've just got to keep on making those messages, because it's really tough at the moment to get our share of the cake.
Alan, what do you think of the idea of a European-level facility?
It's been talked about an awful lot, and without success, I have to say. Certainly the model of CERN, which is a great success, of course, where we pool our resources. We've got European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasting in this country, which is, again, a fantastic success in weather forecasting in collaboration across Europe. Unfortunately, at this time in history, it's really hard to get new resources for a new initiative, of course, because of the economic cycle. I think the other thing that we've been looking at is where countries can pool their existing computational capability and network them better together, so that, in principle, researchers can access machines across Europe. And there is a European project on that. The UK... again, has some issues about how much extra computer power that would bring to bear to researchers, because although you're widening the access to more machines, you're also widening the access to the number of researchers who want to use those machines. So it's not necessarily bringing on board for a particular grand challenge problem like climate the kind of capability that Tim's talking about. So I don't think it's an easy question. I don't think we should stop discussing this in Europe and wider, actually. But I don't think it's straightforward, and particularly now with the current economic conditions.
Tim, did you want to?
Yeah, I'd like to just address the part of the question about data needs, and especially for biogeochemical feedbacks and understanding the response, for example, of the carbon cycle. You might ask, do we know how much carbon dioxide is going into the North Atlantic year on year and what the variability is in that? And if we do, how do we know it? Well, we do know something about that as of the last few years, but only thanks to my friend and colleague Andy Watson and his group having put instrumentation on commercial boats, banana boats actually, the geese boat going, which plies its trade backwards and forwards across the Atlantic and now has taken for a decade or so CO2 measurements as it's been doing so, because we equipped the boat to do that. And it's only because of that that we now have a picture of much greater variability actually in the uptake or release of carbon dioxide in the North Atlantic. And we don't have that coverage in many, well, there are very few other parts of the world ocean where we honestly have the direct data. And so our models happen to have quite a smooth and predictable view of how the ocean uptake of CO2 will continue. The limited data we have is already challenging that view. It's just speaking to the point that we could have much better monitoring, direct monitoring of critical processes, particularly carbon cycle and other biogeochemical processes in the system. And I had the conversation before this session about how well do we monitor the permafrost regions across Siberia and the greenhouse or possible methane release from those. Well, the situation's pretty poor. There's one tall tower with fairly large footprint, which has been a big fight to get that monitoring, one monitoring point in place. And there's so much more we could do to really get a comprehensive picture of the full chemical, biological, as well as physical variability and response of the Earth system.
Thank you, Tim. And finally, this question.
Well, just to say, I mean, I think we have to think European about this modelling issue, computing issue. It's clear in the current economic time there's just no prospect at all of a dedicated, you know, tier zero computer in the UK, funded by UK. So I think we just do have to take inspiration from things like CERN, from the astronomy as well, the European Space Telescopes, and other. Of course, in terms of fusion, I mean, there's now a world collaboration in nuclear fusion in France, which involves both Europe, US, and Japan. I think this has to be looked at in an international context. I can't see any alternative. Personally, I think Europe will lose out if we don't get something together. I mean, already, I think Japan is leading the world in high-resolution climate modelling, and the biggest, fastest supercomputers these days are built in China. So we will lose out unless we can get our act together. So even just for the sake of science, I think we have to start thinking at a much more international level to keep up with the others.
Thanks, Tim. We're heading to our last 10 minutes or quarter of an hour or so. So I'll take two questions, one after the other this time. There's a gentleman up here by the pillar. And there's a gentleman up there, I think with a red shirt on, second row from the back. So if we take you first.
Hello. Perfect. Chris Tyler from the Centre for Science and Policy. I'd just like to say this has been a fantastic panel. It looks like the event is warming up to be a terrific event, and we are very happy in our own small way to have supported this. So thank you to you guys for being such a good panel. My question relates to my impression of a lot of this discussion, which is that there seems to be a degree of certainty about our uncertainty, and that if we have more computing power, we can narrow that down and so on. But I deal a lot with policymakers, and they are quite fond of a philosophical framework laid down by an eminent philosopher, Donald Rumsfeld. If you presented a slide to a policymaker with a solid line, that's the kind of the model with the known stuff. The error bars are the kind of the known unknowns. Now, what do you do when the policy maker, be that a politician or a civil servant or so on, gets interested in unknown unknowns? Depending on the political persuasion of the policy professional, they may put more or less emphasis on that issue. And I wondered, as eminent scientists, how you deal with that.
Who wants to go first? Tim?
I'll give it a go. Good question. I mean, in thinking about possible climate tipping points or eventualities, I think immediately you start exercising your imagination as a scientist, and that's maybe something we aren't trained to do enough, actually. The whole sociology of our field, and I'm sure many others, somewhat blinkers our thinking and our, for example, conceptualization of possible future eventualities. So I don't know exactly sociologically how we engineer a more creative thinking about the possibility space of the future, but how do I do it myself? I simply do it by trying to maintain a keen interest in quite diverse scientific fields and aspects of science and strive for this interdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary perspective to sort of spot the connections that maybe other people aren't seeing. But beyond that, I suspect we could learn a lot from some other fields of academia or more practical real-world methods you may have for getting us to open our minds to possible future eventualities we simply haven't considered. And I know at the moment the government foresight project on environmental change and migration, which I'm sort of loosely doing something for, is very much an exercise in trying to dream up these unknown unknowns of the possible connections. I don't have the answer, but I think it's something we should devote more attention to. And it's particularly pertinent if, like me, you're used to being a modeller or a climate modeller, because we all know the seductive attraction of the model world. Like we call it the Galatea delusion, right? We fall in love with the model and forsake it for the real, forsake the real world for the model. That we have to always fight against that. I personally have I personally have in my office the famous painting of Pygmalion wooing Galatea, the statue. To try and remind me all the time not to fall in love with the model and to think more broadly. But beyond that, we need some I think we could do with some ideas, actually, as to how to do more horizon scanning exercises and more open our minds a bit more to the things we haven't thought of.
Vicky?
I don't think I can really add to that in terms of unknown unknowns. I mean, the only thing is to talk a little bit about the known unknowns. And again, the known unknowns are not included in the models, of course, because they're things that we know are missing, but we haven't yet characterised well enough to model them. And I think by exploring what those will do, at least we can understand some of the risks and some of the sort of particular... And most of these known unknowns, of course, affect the upper end of the scale. They affect the very high sensitivities around... you know, as you get to 4 or 5 degrees of warming, and whether there are these sort of feedbacks, for example, methane releases, permafrost melts. As Tim mentioned, there are very few observations, so we don't have enough information yet. It's starting to include some of the processes in models, but we certainly can't quantify those impacts. And when you look at methane trapped, for example, in the Arctic Ocean, we know very little about how much is there and how that would be released, when it would be released, what the timescales are. So you can at least, if you want to have a slightly less esoteric discussion, actually talk about those known unknowns and what science we understand about them, even if we can't quantify that, and start to explore those sorts of possibilities, which I think helps you to understand the sort of scale of the problem that we're dealing with. So that doesn't really answer your question. But.
Alan, when we get uncertainties and these sorts of issues, is there ever a risk of scientists perhaps trying to oversimplify or suggest a higher level of certainty than actually exists?
I think the climate science community has been pretty rigorous in attempting to quantify uncertainty, and not to gloss over it. I mean, the IPCC process has been very clear right from the beginning about this, and continues to be so. So I think our field is a good one in the sense of capturing uncertainty. Etc. So I'm not too concerned about that. Although, of course, we know that if scientists are tempted to cross over the line into policy advocacy, then there can be issues because some of the uncertainty is not reflected properly, and I think that's a mistake when that happens.
Thank you, Tim. Do you want to say anything about?
I mean, just on that perhaps last point, I mean, I'm often asked about, you know, well, what do I think about cutting emissions and things like that? And, I mean, Alan makes the point, which is right, that as a scientist, what we try to do is you know, give the science advice about the likely future, the probabilities of really seriously or potentially catastrophic climate change. Going into the issue of advocacy, of course, that kind of takes you beyond the purely scientific. I have to say, though, as just a sort of a citizen, if you like, of the UK, I think the government is taking exactly the right line on emissions cuts. In the light, I'm saying this because we spent the whole of this afternoon talking about uncertainties, but nevertheless, we're talking about potentially very serious changes to our climate system, potentially catastrophic changes to our climate system. So if I can sort of take off my scientist hat and just put on a citizen hat, I think the government is taking the right line, that despite these uncertainties, we have to start thinking now about trying to avoid the worst types of climate change. However, you know, policy decisions that are made need to be continually revised in the light of emerging science. And it is really important, I think, from this afternoon to recognize that the science is not done and dusted. There are many uncertainties that we genuinely believe we can narrow, both with advancing science and with better technology. And so it's this continual kind of interaction between science and policy that will take us forward. Unknown unknowns, maybe a meteorite will hit us in 50 years' time and we'll be dead anyway, but I don't think that stops us from taking these issues very seriously, nevertheless.
Okay, as a gentleman at the back who I meant to ask last time around and forgot.
Is this on?
Have you still got the mic?
Yep. Duncan Martin from Boston Consulting Group. We often have discussions with clients where they say, we'd love to work with you. How can you make it self-funding? And I just wondered, what was your one best idea within the context of climate change for being able to get a self-funding idea?
That's a great final question. Who wants to start? We can just go straight down the panel, if you like. That puts you first, Tim.
No, again. So you mean what idea is going to fund itself to fruition? Well, it's maybe a risky one, but I'm really trying to devote my attention, especially in the Isaac Newton Institute program, at this: are there early warning signals of nonlinear changes? And we can see them in the past records, as Tim Palmer showed the slide. We can see that there are precursors or early warnings before some distinct nonlinear changes in the past. So I'm willing to take the risk that actually that methodology has something in it. It's not perfect, but that information could be of considerable societal value. And it will be a very difficult challenge to try and operationalise early warning systems for what I might call climate tipping points. But we might be able to start small with the more promising looking systems and advance from there. And the prospect there is that the cost benefit looks very good, that in principle it's a relatively low cost investment for some potentially valuable information. We've learnt that from the progress in seasonal forecasting, which of course Tim Palmer's been instrumental in. We learnt that we could provide some lead time of forecast for whether there was going to be an El Nino 9 months, full El Nino 9 months later, and that's potentially hugely valuable information at relatively low cost for those wanting in agricultural sector and health and malaria. I believe we can actually progress on that, and we can achieve ultimately longer lead times in early warning for ultimately larger, what you might call state changes in the system.
I mean, just to be clear, what I took from your question was that does better forecasting and better modelling offer ways of saving money, or perhaps of raising insurance premiums, or justification, therefore? Is that a reasonable interpretation?
It would be, for example, finding a way to cut expenditure over the next 5 years, because in the next 5 years you would find an offsetting benefit.
Yeah, Vicky.
Well, I think it's really about finding things that you can predict that actually have a financial benefit, I guess. And, certainly we're starting to work with the insurance industry to look for those sorts of things. And I think it's about largely things like predicting extreme events, tropical storms, anything which for the insurance sector or anything that you have to insure, obviously then there's a financial benefit to anybody that invests in that type of technology and those types of forecasts. But of course there are many other instances, and certainly in terms of the government's investment in climate change and looking at the impact of climate change and adaptation, it is about ultimately saving money. So the work that was done, we did work with the Environment Agency looking at the replacement for the Thames Barrier, the TE2100 project, and they were looking at different levels of climate change, different levels of sea level rise, and what type of barrier would be required for that. And so, as part of that, we looked at the worst case scenario. And when that was done in 2002, we said that it's possible that there could be up to a 4 metre sea level rise by 2100, because we didn't know enough about the science of what might happen to the Greenland ice sheet. Could it all break up and very large amounts of sea level rise very quickly? We're now able to rule that out and say that the worst case scenario would give us a 2 metre sea level rise. Now, clearly, that's a huge saving in investment in terms of flood risk that needs to be protected against. We still wouldn't suggest that anybody actually invested large sums of money at this point in protecting against a 2 metre sea level rise, because we think it's very unlikely. It's just the worst case scenario. But what you can then do is, in 20 years' time, when you might actually have to start thinking about investing to protect against that, that actually we should have better information and we should be able to narrow down that uncertainty range again. So that's a good example of where it will, that this kind of information can really save you money or save the country money.
Alan. You ask exactly the same question that George Osborne asked me about the spending review and the science and research budget. It's what does this knowledge get used for in terms of economic benefit to the UK, actually, in the particular case of the UK research budget. And I think, what we're talking about here is really living with environmental change and having foresight of what environmental change is coming. And that economic benefit from that is to avoid the costs that come from the unpleasant aspects of environmental change, whether they be hazards or the list that Rowan gave us of the hazards going forward. So the foresight gives us the ability to reduce the cost that we would otherwise have from those hazards. But I think increasingly there are, because of our scientific knowledge and lead in this field, there are also opportunities, therefore, for new business areas and new economic areas to develop on the back of having that foresight of how the environment is going to change into the future. And, obviously the concept of the green economy is there, and clearly a number of us would like to suggest to government that that's a real economic opportunity for the UK going forward, but a number of other countries are getting into this area. So it's absolutely how we need to think about how knowledge is used. And those two areas, I think we've got a great story to tell in environmental change on those economic opportunities. But many of the business areas and opportunities, talked about reinsurance, are very much at the early growth phase. We've got a tremendous opportunity because they're relatively new business sectors. And my hope is the government can recognise that growth opportunity in these new areas and actually develop those going forward. Because, we have the intellectual firepower in this country to be able to provide the raw material for that.
Tim, you started and no chance to finish.
Okay, huh? I think I've got three small comments. Sort of picking up what Alan said, I mean, as we move into this era of thinking about infrastructure to adapt to climate change, we do have to make sure we don't maladapt. We don't want to waste money. So it's not exactly, if we're going to spend money, we have to spend it wisely, and we need proper science to back up that expenditure. As far as things like reinsurance, though, I just want to pick up something the other Tim said about seasonal forecasting, because I think that is a potentially very exciting area for a number of businesses. For example, one thing we see very clear evidence of is seasonal timescale predictability of hurricane numbers. The El Nino event really controls hurricanes in the Atlantic sector substantially, and as does, for example, in the monsoon regions. El Nino controls. So the floods we had in Pakistan, one could say that the onset of the La Nina, the opposite phase to El Nino, was very much conducive to a sort of
intense monsoon activity. And I kind of see this as, I mean, and think about this year, that the flooding in Pakistan was meteorologically actually linked to the heat waves in Russia and the consequent loss of wheat and crop yields in that area, which had economic impacts on the UK. So prediction of these types of major climatic anomalies, particularly those in the tropics, I would say, manifestly has enormous economic implications for the city here and elsewhere. And I think actually that's going to be a really exciting growth area in climate science. So as well as the longer-term climate change issues, this kind of short-term prediction of climate variability.
Thank you, Tim. We've had
I just wanted to say one last thing. As I said on my slide, I personally have no problem if the private sector wants to come in and co-fund with the public sector the supercomputers. I mean, this should be a partnership between both. If you're benefiting from these models, come in and help us fund the sort of scales that we need to
We're
make
moving
reliable
from
predictions.
Into a sales pitch now.
Thank you. Yes.
Many thanks to the panel, Tim Palmer, Alan Thorpe, Vicky Pope, Tim Lenton. It's been a very interesting session, I hope. I hope you found it so as well. And we're going to make way now for coffee, I think. Is that right? So we'll see you back here at 2:45, or is it? Sorry, 4:45.
20 to 30 minutes. I'm going to consult with the next chairman.
Okay. Thanks again.